if we go straight in.
Yes.
It's half a century now. Has Pakistan developed a clear sense of national identity?
I don't think so, really. I think it had a very clear sense of national identity when Pakistan came into being in 1947. It was a tremendous popular movement which resulted in the emergence of Pakistan as a separate state. And I think Jinnah's great contribution was that he dramatized the fact of separateness. I mean, the reality of separateness, even today in India, the Muslims and Hindus are separate. And I, as a student, knew, even in Muslim-majority Punjab, that you were separate. And I think he somehow dramatized this fact, and it needed no argument, because right from one end of the subcontinent to the others, the Muslims responded to this fact of separateness. So that separate identity was a political reality about which there was really no argument. And that reality did assert itself. There were various other political reasons, but this is the basic, I think, feature of that national identity you asked me about. I think since then, you see, to claim separateness is one thing, and to achieve separateness is one thing. But then, what do you do with separateness after you become a nation state? I think we couldn't solve that problem. Then the principles of separateness which had resulted in the emergence of Pakistan were the secular democratic principles of majority opinion. That is, areas where you are living together, ostensibly. Let it be decided by the people. And if the majority says we want to separate, then they separate. So this majority principle also was also the one that Jinnah kept on asserting, that he only added that it applies to a nation state, not to two nation states. Okay, you get your nation state, the majority principle triumphs, your separateness is established. What do you do with that? Then all the contradictions arose. You had East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, which was 56% of the population, and you were bound by the majority principle, and you didn't want to obey that principle anymore. Certainly not the ruling class, which was mostly from West Pakistan, mostly from Punjab and UP and the frontier. The Balochis, the Sindhis, the Bengalis were really out of that system. And I served for about 6 years in East Pakistan between 1950 and 1956. And I could see the same separateness, because basically the separateness was economic separateness, the sense of exploitation, whatever color it was given. And the Pakistani leaders, as well as the intelligentsia, particularly in West Pakistan, they could not reconcile themselves to the principle of majority rule. You know the number of things they did. I mean, they combined all the smaller provinces with Punjab and West Pakistan, called it one unit. What was the purpose? Not any political or administrative purpose, but to frustrate the majority principle, because now we are one unit, you are one unit. So we have what was called parity of representation. So the majority principle was damaged there. I think that did incalculable damage to the concept or sense of national identity. You started thinking in separate terms. the idea that it was one state and all the federating units were equal autonomous partners where majority opinion determined the affairs of the state. I think that became really quite irrelevant. And therefore you receded from national identity to regional identity, to provincial identity, to ethnic identity, to linguistic identity. And now I'm afraid we've reached the stage of tribal identity. It's the tribes which are determining. I mean, what does the Khosa tribe feel and what does the Lagari tribe feel in Pakistan today decides who will be a member of a provincial cabinet or not. I think this rise of feudalism since independence has been the most important factor which has been nearly ignored by observers, because they see the government still, you know, they have the elections and they have the assemblies while, you know, they can't work it, and then everybody thinks they're incompetent. But the basic thing is that you're trying to impose a democratic system on a feudal society, which just is not possible. And so you really have now tribal identity, ethnic identity, linguistic identity, but basically there is no sense of interdependence between the federating units and the center.
This means that the two-nation theory is now full of holes.
No, the two-nation theory, in fact, the two-nation theory is re-establishing itself. You see, if you use the theory of a nation for exploitation, for repression, for denying the rights of communities, it will go on asserting itself. You see, this nation theory works in a very mysterious way. I mean, you look at the identity crisis or transformation going on in Europe. It is because of economic interdependence, sense of self-respect. You are not losing no rights being a member of the European Union, where you feel that this might damage us, you say, okay, common currency, let's think about it. But the two-nation theory was a fact of life. That fact of life is asserting itself again. That was a fact of life which took the form of protest against the exploitation of the majority community. That fact is reasserting itself. So I don't think it's a question. Many people say that it's the supposing the two-nation theory hadn't worked and the Hindus and the Muslims have gone on living together, you would have had the same situation which you have between, forget Kashmir, but between the Muslims of India and the Brahmins of India.
Taking a slightly different tack, have Pakistanis and particularly...
Give you some tea?
Okay.
Yes. What do you do?
Personal history. In Lahore, you said...
I know about the fact of separateness as a very young student. Now, how old would I have been? About 12 or 13. I must have been about 13, and I went into this government high school in Lahore Cantonment. And I was one of two Muslim students. And the history teacher, when he's taking the roll call, came to my name. It used to be a bit longer name than Altaf Hussain Gaurur Rahman. I abbreviated it later. And the word Hussain, you know, gave me away. So he said, in my class, whenever I come in, you stand up and remain standing. And I just couldn't believe what was going on. And I had a Sikh teacher who was so affectionate, so kind. So this sense, and I tried very hard to cultivate Hindu friends, and I did succeed, but, and they were very, very nice friends, going to the library together, sitting down. But when it came to any social contact, then it was quite clear that there are certain things which are forbidden and which are not acceptable between Hindus and Muslims. And this kept kept growing.
What sort of things?
Well, I mean, point is that you will never have a chance to eat together. If you went like this, if you had tea and sat down, that just was not on. It was not on. You couldn't even have a glass of water in the house of the teacher. That was not possible because the utensil which was used would be polluted. The cup in which they would think of giving you a tea would have to be broken. And it was absolutely clearly understood. You lived in separate streets, you had separate shops, particularly food shops were totally segregated. There was no question of a Hindu buying from a Muslim shop any fruit or vegetables, leave alone meat and beef and other things. And it had somehow, I don't know how, but even though they were in a majority, Muslims in Punjab had become a very repressed class. I mean, all the teachers, all the engineers, all the lawyers, they were all Hindus or Englishmen. Very, very few Muslims in the profession.
So you felt, and certainly the way you're describing yourself as being treated by Hindu friends, almost an outcast in your own land?
No. I didn't feel that. Sorry. I didn't feel that. I think my Muslim friends and I, we had a tremendous sense of pride in the Punjab. We also had a great sense that physically we are stronger and we could knock the hell out of them. So, it wasn't that you felt an outcast. You just felt that somehow you'd been left out or marginalized. How that happened was a mystery. Whether it was the British rule and the way they kept control over the majority community in Punjab or in Bengal. These were the two major Muslim majority areas. And both these areas, the Muslims were really totally depressed, repressed, and exploited class.
You say that you and your friends felt that you could knock the stuffing out of the Hindus.
Yeah.
When that was actually happening in Lahore from the spring of 47 onwards, did you find that people that you would expect to be saying, halt, no, this must stop, were actually acquiescing?
I was in Madras at that time. I came to Lahore once before partition. Lahore then was Khushwant Singh, Manzoor Qadir and these people. And even though I was rather young, I was a member of that group. Because one Christian woman who later married a member of the Indian Civil Service, she was a very popular person and I was a very great friend. And I used to go to these big parties with her, ICS and others, these big bureaucrats. So when I came in June or July, in my own house I found a number of arms had been stacked, guns and swords and whatnot. Now, this was a very peaceful, non-violent family. We knew nothing of violence at all. Nowhere in our family had ever been any incidents of violence. So I asked my late father, why have you collected all these weapons? And he said, you go to sleep at night. We used to sleep on the roof, it was summer, June, July. And I heard nothing but slogans and noises, Hindu slogans, Sikh slogans, Muslim slogans. And every household was, waiting when it might be attacked. And then when I talked to people like Khushwant and so on, The Sikhs in this place, Rawalpindi, had been literally butchered by the Muslims. And all the women had come to a camp in Lahore, and I went to see them. And I just couldn't believe how human beings could have been so brutal.
Tell me about the camp that you visited.
This is where the Sikhs from, you know, all there were two or three Sikh villages near Rawalpindi where the Muslims started attacking those villages and literally killed all the menfolk, and the women and children were brought to Lahore. And they were there. And this is June, July, 47. So it had started, it was one of the first, if not the first, communal incident.
And what state were the women in?
In a terrible state. They were crying, and they were all trying to tell me, Jinnah has ordered them to kill us. Jinnah has ordered them to kill us. So the feeling was being built up among the Sikhs that it's Jinnah who is asking the Muslims here to kill all the Sikhs, so, and then the retaliation began. I mean, Jinnah, poor man, didn't know a thing about this. He was not a violent man. And he used to keep telling Mountbatten that I hear that these violent incidents are taking place. And Mountbatten would say, you know, I am a naval man. I know what law and order is. And I assure you there are no such incidents to take. Even though his own commanders, field commanders, were giving him all the reports. But the man absolutely refused to accept the fact. With the result that all these leaders, Hindus, Sikhs and Muslims, Jinnah, Nehru, they all got involved in the questions of power. And had no time to think of what was going on. I'm sure they were all totally taken aback, as I was, of the enormity of hatred that demonstrated itself. You say where the people who knew each other were started killing? Yes, all over the place this was going on. And we still talk about the few individuals, few Muslims who gave refuge to a few Sikhs or Hindus, or a few Hindus who gave refuge to a few. But by and large, everyone was for killing. I don't know what particular vendetta they were sorting out, but it was, I mean, I was one of the most scared people. I just couldn't understand. I went by train, finally, after I came from Delhi, from Lahore to Karachi. And I just couldn't understand why my compartment was empty, but I was busy reading and so on. When I got down at Karachi, they were taking dead bodies out because the train had been attacked twice as it was going near the border, Indian-Pakistan border, in Sindh. So it was very difficult to understand.
Been attacked by Sindhi Muslims?
By Sindhi Hindus and gangs from across the border. So it was said. I mean, I wouldn't know. But I know that all those dead bodies were of Muslims coming from Lahore to Karachi.
And this was after partition?
No. I came to from Lahore to Karachi on the 10th of August. So this is the 10th of August. And the man who met me at the railway station and took me to the house where I was to stay, you know, being entitled as a government officer, that was a Sikh gentleman, a contractor, who was saying, I've built all those quarters for you people and you come. And so I went along with that Sikh gentleman. So it was a very odd situation that normal life was going on at some levels, and yet all over the place incidents were taking place which the administration was taking no notice of. And then they were overtaken by the events of partition, which forced people to leave their homes and then gave an opportunity to all those people who wanted to grab property or to loot and so on. So they all came into the picture.
Some people say that Punjabis, West Punjabis, have not come to terms with the extent of the violence, that there's a large sector of Punjabi opinion that simply doesn't want to improve relations with India because they think they still feel bitter about 47.
Well, you see, the major killings between the Punjabi Muslims and the non-Muslims were between the Muslims of Punjab and the Sikhs of East Punjab. The way the Muslim Punjabis have reconciled themselves to the Sikhs is nobody's business. I mean, there's total understanding. This is not only when the separate Punjab movement started in India, then of course it assumed a political color and General Ziaul Haq was, you know, backing it up. I'm talking of earlier days that somehow the Muslims never kept that hatred against the Sikhs who were mainly involved in the killings. But the feeling, the anti-Hindu feeling, was much stronger in the Punjab than it is in any part of West or East Pakistan as it was originally. It's that day-to-day segregation which created that. No, absolutely no contact. And no jobs for you. I mean, I as a student used to be told, don't try to learn mathematics. No beef eater can learn mathematics. So you had, by 1947, you had three or four prominent students of mathematics, maybe one or two people in physics and chemistry, and the rest were all like me, English, literature, history, philosophy, Persian. You know, we'd been reduced to that. I did my master's in MA, in English, from Government College, Lahore. It was really impossible for me. I had secured a very high position, top position. But I couldn't get a job except as a lecturer in Islamic College. There were no openings at all. I think these things, right down to the village level, the villagers were all indebted, loaned, and, you know, made to pay high interests and so on. And most of their whatever property they had was mortgaged. And in professions, there was total exclusiveness. I mean, I know in Lahore, in the profession of law, apart from Manzoor Qadir and an uncle of his, there was just no Muslim lawyer worth the name. And certainly no engineers and no doctors and no accountants. And this is right up to 47, this is the situation. So I think this grievance, it's not a religious grievance. Because if it were a religious exploitation, is not, religion might heighten it. It was the same kind of grievance and the same kind of hatred that the Bengali Muslims felt for the West Pakistanis. I think it's very important to understand that, because you simplify thinking there's Muslims and Hindus. Nothing of the sort. It is the fact of exploitation. Because if being Muslims could bring you together, then you should have had no problem with your East Pakistani Muslims. What was the problem? If they were in a majority, they could run the country and that would be all right. But you see, the power game excludes, the power elite excludes the common person. And very soon the common person knows that religion is being used to exploit me. And so religion becomes irrelevant. I think between the Hindus and the Muslims, this thing, unfortunately, the Hindus have not understood it any better than the Muslims. I asked many of my Hindu friends, you know, after the emergence of Bangladesh, I said, listen, I served there for 6 years. I knew the language, I know the people. I lost many, many friends. Could you tell me that when you went there, you were treated as saviors, you were garlanded, and the West Pakistani army surrendered, and how come within 6 months you alienated the population of Bangladesh so completely that all my friends who now come from there to London just tell me this, that these are terrible people. They exploit us, they take away everything that we have, they have no time for us, they dominate, they're arrogant. So I used to say, even more arrogant than the Punjabis like us. Oh, he said yes, but certainly no less. Now this is going, I don't think there is any case in history where a group of saviors has been discarded in less than 6 months' time. So I think we, until these people understand that it is not religion, it's exploitation. It's exploitation. Incidents like killings of the Muslims that goes on, or in Bombay the assertion of Hindu this and that, they aggravate. The basic causes are not that. What are the basic causes in Kashmir? Is it religion? I know a Kashmiri woman married to an American who went to Srinagar and came back because as an American she was allowed to go there. And met me in London, and she said, listen, the point is simple. These Kashmiri Muslims have no jobs. They have no trade. They have to get a license from Delhi even to export fruit. The entire trade is in the hands of what are called the pundits. And it is absolute exploitation which has driven them to this slogan of independence or plebiscite or whatever you call it. And everybody else has jumped into that. But the basic cause is that you have so many years to reconcile yourself to the reality of Kashmiri Muslims or Sikhs in the Punjab, and you refuse to do that, exactly as the West Pakistanis refuse to accept the Bengali Muslims. I mean, the Hindus may have an added reason that they are Muslims, but the West Pakistanis didn't spare any brutality, even though they were using their weapons against Muslims. So I think this exploitation, this is the fact which is not realized. So everybody sits down, let's discuss Kashmir, and is this a dispute? Is this a problem? Is this an issue? This damn the English language, you know. It's really gripped the mind of the people in the subcontinent. You go to a court, they are discussing the meaning of consultation, dictionaries being consulted. I mean, things which are taken for granted, let's say in courts in Britain, are being debated. What is the power of the head of state and what is the balance of power? It's a call a question of, you know, retaining power with the use of, in this instance, use of language. And in the case of this hatred, as you say, this is an aggravate, this can be used as a provocation and as an aggravating factor, the fact of Hindu-Muslim enmity, shall we call it. But I think the root cause is the sense of isolation and exploitation.
And the root cause of the failure of India and Pakistan to live together, is that because Pakistan fears it will be exploited if trade and political and social and cultural contacts open up?
Well, you see, they have so many. The number of Muslims in India is a very large, it's a very large community. They have very close contacts with the large number of people, they visit. And the stories they tell you are really the same old stories of isolation and exploitation. Same old stories, I hear. I mean, there is a doctor, an Indian Muslim doctor, running a very, very good hospital in England, who has all his relations in Lucknow. And whenever he comes, these are the stories that he tells me. I haven't been to see them, so I don't know. I can't say as a matter. I mean, I can say about the exploitation of the Balochis and the Sindhis and the Bengalis, which I saw. But whether the Indian ruling classes are exploiting the Muslims or the Sikhs or the Kashmiris, that I can only judge by what I read or what I hear. But I have no doubt that in Pakistan the determining factor which has created this climate of uncertainty about the future and the loss of national identity is economic exploitation. I'm not a socialist or a communist of any kind, but I at least recognize when I see that the rights are being denied to a domestic servant because he's not a Punjabi, he's a Sindhi, then he will be treated differently. And there is tremendous, let's say, cultural ego with the Muhajirs. I mean, they are a small community, but I must say the government here has knocked the hell out of that community. Really, the kind of state terrorism I never thought I'd live to see. But the problem is exploitation. This is it. No, we won't let you get. Muhajirs are better.